first question as each week, do you have any questions? Last week we made it to those slides. Any questions to them while the slides go forward? No questions? Hopefully everything's clear. Okay. Then I ask you to do the exercise to and this exercise asks you to change perspective. Usually, if you build system, the perspective, of course, is, hey, how can we build them as secure as possible? And at least, theoretically, maybe for some actors, even in practice, it might make sense to try to do the contrary. How could I design a system which is as insecure as possible and nevertheless will be a huge success on the mass market? I think this is a perspective which might be interesting for two reasons. One is, if you completely inverse the perspective, maybe you come across many errors one might make. And secondly, maybe I'm paranoid, but there are surely secret services who are very eager that the technology in the hands of the might-be enemies is as insecure as possible. At least as seen from their perspective. So, we started a discussion about security in distributed systems, and the basic fact is that the security for a user of a system usually cannot be better than the security of the terminal he interacts with. Assuming this is the only terminal he or she interacts with, and there's no, let's say, communication channel bypassing that terminal. Of course, if you have other terminals, if you are using them, of course, if you have other channels, then, of course, security can be better than the security of the system you're interacting with, because on another channel, you can transmit the same information that the user compared, for example. So let's assume you have only one terminal, and we want to build it as insecure as possible. What would we do? Put out proposals. What would you do? How would you do? Maybe I should give you the... Do you have the mic with you? Okay, then he needs it. I have it, yes. Okay,
Okay, I would create very, very complex with a high complexity that no normal user can understand how the system works, first of all.
So the first rule truly should be make it complicated.
Yes, for the normal user.
This, for the normal user.
And even for advanced users. The experts which create a device should know what it does, but...
So let's make a discussion what complicated shall mean. Do you talk about the user interface, or do you talk about the inner workings of the system?
The inner working system.
Okay, here I fully agree. Because if you want to hide something, you need complexity. The more complexity you have, the more you can hide. On the other hand, if you want your system to be as a kind of success in the mass market, of course, the user interface has to be as simple as possible. Okay, so first statement, we need complexity in the inner workings of the system, and maybe a very simple, maybe even a simplistic user interface. Okay, additional suggestion. Can you draw some conclusions that you want to have a very, very, very simple user interface with respect to security? Usually, just think about your normal life. If you have the feeling that you haven't any enemies on Earth, I would assume life gets much simpler, right? If you have the feeling that nobody ever will work against your interest, life gets much more simple. So having that kind of feeling surely is nice. Everybody likes that, right? Or did you ever miss enemies? At least I didn't. So if you want to make a user interface very, very simple, not considering security or safety of the user in any way, helps you. It makes it more simple. So just omit all kinds of security. Sounds great. It's good for user acceptance and gives you a simpler user interface. Okay. Other suggestions? We had the inner workings of the system, and to start with, we said it should be complex, right? Can we have a closer look at that kind of complexity? I would prefer if different parts of the system are built by different parties. It would even be better if each user had a slightly different system. Could be even better if some complexity of the system is generated by the user implicitly. Do you come across some ideas how to build that? Let's assume you have some data formats in your computer. Let's assume you have a program which can handle that data format. What shall happen? You click it and then software downloads automatically in your machine. Would be nice. Gives you a very simple user interface and makes you configure implicitly the complexity on your machine, right? Sounds nice. So whenever you want to have a kind of Trojan horse installed in user machines, make sure there's a data format which needs the software you put on the internet for implicit download. Sounds nice. What else would you make sure on the machine? So let's assume your software as the attacker has been downloaded implicitly. What would you like to be possible for that software?
I would first of all try to hide the code and no one is allowed to see the code what the program really does.
Okay, so only distributing your software in object code would be a good idea. Don't write it in Java and let it compile on your victim's system, right? Okay. What else?
I would hide such communication channels within the system that has access to some kind of operating system functionality and so on, and you don't see it.
Okay. So the software, it should be usual practice that your software communicates after you downloaded it with the internet. Or for many purposes, then it would be easy for the software to spread your secrets, because communication is normal. Ever thought about softwares you download calling home to the originator? Think about it. Of course, the argument would be, hey, we want to control how our software is used. It's only that we can make a business out of it. It's not getting at the secrets of users. What else would you like to hold on the machine the user is using? How about access control? Would you like to have access control in place? So the software which is downloaded implicitly is confined to some data. So usually we started that you double click a file and you download data. What would you like to hold?
Maybe there's access control only for the user and not for...
Okay, so you would like, what to make it seriously, we would like to hold is you double click a file, you download a software or you activate a software, and this software has only access to this file you double click, no other files, right? This is what you would like to be in place. This would be access control, this would be least privilege. Now, if we are changing perspective, what would you like to hold? No access control in place. So you double click something, the software starts, and the software has access to everything on your computer, right? Ever heard about a computer where this is the case? Probably most computers you're using to accept that. And for example, in Windows 98, Windows Millennium Edition, there just wasn't any access control. And if you think about, even if you have access control in place, and you keep the user interface simplistic, as simple as possible, you would never hope that a Windows pops up asking the user for consent, should this software be able to access that kind of data. No user likes that kind of question, right? So, do a default policy that give access to that token. Sounds user-friendly. Helps to make it a huge success on the market. So it's great, right? Other proposals?
I would try to convince the users that the system is safe and neat.
Okay, so give it a nice logo. Give it, you are using the software of the world leader in software. That's nice. Should be secure because the majority is always right. Yes? We are living in a democracy. So if everyone uses that kind of system, probably it's okay to use it.
The machine should also be communicating all the time, and so that if someone attacks you, it's a constant channel.
Yes. So if you could argue, we need, of course, a machine which is always on. Ever heard that kind of slogan? This sounds nice. Great. Yes. What else would you like to do?
I think you should build in many multimedia devices, for example, a camera or a GPS device or microphone and so on, so you can collect a lot of information if you have access to this.
Yes, so if the machine has many, many different kinds of sensors, this gives you possibilities to collect input. Sounds great. Ever heard about ambient intelligence? Ever heard about computers and infrastructure who should sense what the users want? Which by definition means that sensors have to be in place. Ever heard about that? Sounds great, and of course the user interface is nice. A computer which always does what you want it to do, sounds great. No slavery anymore. Only computers serving us. You never be getting the slaves of our machine. They are just serving us. What other aspects are essential? I would argue this device, of course, should be multi-purpose. It should integrate a wide range of services. So everybody would need it, at least the device, nearly all the time. So you make sure the device is taken with the user, which gives, let's say, much more interesting data to the sensors. Okay.
This device should have a security meter with LEDs that's always on high when the user thinks that he's computing in a secure fashion.
Yes.
So yes, trained to computing that security.
Okay. So giving the user some feeling that everything is all right sounds great. Okay. So let's assume it would be a splendid good idea if we have some security companies which sell security software, and getting the user to subscribe to that, giving him automatic updates, let's say each day or two, and okay, then the user feels quite okay. If you think back, even for Windows 98, Millennium Edition, without any access control, you got security software looking for viruses. For me, it was just ridiculous. But hopefully, it gave a warm feeling to the users that security was okay. Surely, you paid for it. And of course, this is a good business for everyone. So you get a completely insecure system, you get some companies which pretend to make it less insecure. Of course, the jargon is to make it now fully secure if you subscribe and get regular updates. It sounds great. Everybody gets what he wants, except the user. Okay, he gets a warm feeling. This is surely something the user wants. But in substance, probably he doesn't get what he wants. Okay? So probably, until you started to think Advocatus Diaboli, you had surely the feeling that a laptop, a computer, serving many, many, many purposes, having at the user interface no consideration of security, this really is a nice device. Probably this was the perception you had. And I admit that in a world in which there aren't any conflicts, I would say I fully agree, this would be very nice. But in a world with conflicts, I would just say, hey, this is not the way we can go. Of course, the Secret Service would say, hey, that's nice. If we can make the companies of our country world leader in software, if we can get some kind of cooperation with that kind of companies which are world leader, then we get the Trojan horses built in. Sounds good. Even better is if some of the secret services of the world can unite forces. And this is what happened in the past. And when it ever gets obvious, what will you hear? It's all about law enforcement. We are not spying on citizens just to spy on them. We are only looking for terrorists, and it's about law enforcement and fighting organized crime. That's it. No lawful citizen should ever feel that we do anything against him. Is this right? Even if we assume that secret services and police of nearly all countries are very friendly to the law-abiding citizens, even if we assume that, which I would argue is a very daring assumption in history, because usually great much power is used for that. Even then, the security of the system as just described can be broken by organized crime and bad intention people. So to enable some kind of global surveillance, they built an infrastructure which can be misused by others. And those others surely will misuse it. How will you notice? Probably organized crime will not stand up and say, hey, here we're sending you email, your computer has been misused. Thank you. What will happen? Probably sometimes many money will disappear. Of course it doesn't disappear really. It's only managed then by another person. Another organization. Does this happen? Yes, it does. Some gangs can organize robbery and break-ins into flats and houses quite perfectly. Why? And how? Probably because they know when people are at home. If you have access to the computers, you know, or the mobile phones, you know where they are, the users. And usually you can infer how much time you have just to find what is really worth taking with you as a thief. And I could argue many more arguments. So probably, at least the chances are good that this is happening. Okay, this was the negative side of our general purpose laptops and smartphones. And what would you do? What do we need to do? Turning it into positive things. What is really needed? Okay. For example, access control. If you double click something, if you dare downloading software automatically, then this software has to be confined. And at least in the log files of your computer, there should be an entry enabling everyone, you, maybe some people you trust, to reconstruct what happened in the machine. And so on and so forth. All the stories we have in talking about security of computers. Right. And this was the last slide we had last week. So you learned about three algorithms. One algorithm to encrypt, one algorithm to decrypt. These two algorithms are assumed to be public, and therefore we need something which helps us keep different entities distinguishable. If everybody would use the same algorithms without any, let's say, possibility to make them specific, then we could not make a difference between different actors. And for that purpose, cryptographic algorithms are using keys. So encryption is using a key. Decryption is using the key. And in symmetric systems, hopefully, it only works if the two keys are the same. So we need keys. And of course, keys need to be generated. And therefore, we need a third algorithm called key generation to make sure everybody is using different keys, hopefully. Key generation needs as input a random number. And here, please remember what randomness means. It should be a random number which is not predictable by anyone and whose probability is pretty low. If it would be predictable, what would you do? You just use the publicly known key generation algorithm, you would use the predictable random number and you would generate the key, right? I told you everyone using cryptography, except if you do it in your head, which then hopefully is a trusted domain, needs some kind of IT system forming a domain of trust. So usually this is some kind of PC, for example. That could be some kind of PC. And then the service offers you can transmit your ciphertext through an area of attack where an attacker might tap the message to decrypt. Today, if cryptography is broken, usually it's broken in this domain of trust or that domain of trust. So it's not the cryptography which is broken, usually, but the machine implementing encryption, decryption, or maybe key generation. I mentioned that encryption can be understood as an opaque box, a box where you cannot look into, and this box has a lock. And for this lock, you have two identical keys. So the person doing the secret message in the box can lock it using his or her key, and then send the box through an untrusted domain, and the recipient who has another key can open the box. And if you want to implement that, then of course we give names to the algorithms and have to agree on the number and sequence of parameters. Okay. So far we got last. Any questions? Okay, then the usual question is, or the natural question is, hey, I did spell out here that encryption and decryption have to be performed in the domain of trust. What about key generation? Do we need a domain of trust here? And surely the answer is yes, we need it. And I hope we didn't depict it, because we have many possibilities how to implement. So we'll see. But before we see that, so we go a little bit into key distribution, I should give you an example. And the example for the symmetric encryption system I give you is a very famous example. In some sense, you can argue that this is the symmetric encryption system. The most secure, the best known, and in some sense we could argue it's perfectly secure. Let's see. The idea is encryption is just adding up something. For example, what is 2, and you can generalize it, or we can add it up in any group. Decryption, if you added up mod 2, decryption is the same operation as encryption, adding up mod 2. If you generalize it to groups, you would say I'm doing the inverse group operation, or I'm adding up the inverse element. So let's now consider we do it mod 2, that is, we are handling bits, binary digits, separate. So let's see. Let's assume we have an attacker. Oh, first, before I discuss security, I should argue how are keys generated and why does it work. Okay, key generation is just identity. It's just an algorithm doing nothing. So an input of a random number, key generation is just copying, that's it. So the key is a completely random number. And all we know, and what we have of course to make certain, is that this key is exactly that key. So why does it work? So if you have some plain text and you add a key bit, mod 2, and you add it once more, then you know it's canceling each other. So if you add something and later on subtract something, it cancels. So this is the reason why when you start with the plain text here, you have here and there the same key. You're ending up with the same plain text at the right hand side, assuming the ciphertext is not tampered with during transmission. But we are talking about encryption, so we may assume that ciphertexts are not changed. We'll discuss authentication, that is preventing undetected change, in a few minutes. So now it's clear, why does it work? Next argument is, why is it secure? In the sense that, why does it provide confidentiality? Let's take the perspective of an attacker who is listening to bits here in the area of attack. Let's assume he sees a zero. So we have the green keys. The attacker is interested, what's the plaintext bit behind it? Now there are, of course, for bits two possibilities. It could be zero and it could be one. So the attacker knows ciphertext is zero and he asks himself the question, what is the plaintext bit? Now he has two possibilities. It could be a zero, and then the key bit would be zero as well, because zero plus zero mod 2 yields zero. Or it could be a plaintext bit 1, because 1 plus 1 mod 2 yields zero. And why can we now argue that this cipher for the green case is unbreakable? Because depending on the value of the key bit, which is only used once, never reused, the two possible values of the key open which plain text bit we have. So the attacker doesn't learn anything about the plain text bits by knowing that the ciphertext bit is zero. Now we do the blue case. Let's assume the attacker sees a 1. Now he has the possibilities it could be the plaintext 0, and then the key bit would be 1. Or it could be a plaintext 1, and then the key bit would be 0. And again, seeing this plaintext bit keeps open both possibilities for the plaintext, because both key values are equally likely. So it doesn't matter whether the attacker listens to a ciphertext with 0 or 1, he doesn't learn anything about the corresponding plaintext. And this is called information theoretical security, because the attacker is just lacking any information in the Shannon sense, in the sense as you call Shannon-defined information about the plaintext. You've got it, I hope. So what's good and what's bad with this system? I would argue it has a few very strong sides. One is that we can really do a security analysis which is quite simple. So I would assume if you really understood what I'm talking about, you should be able to explain it to your parents. So probably it's a good exercise in Christmas, because it gets boring after all the presents has been handed over. If it gets really boring, then you say, hey, I have a nice story, and this is something which is very important for the next decade, so you should learn something. Okay, let's talk about it. You should be possible to explain it to your parents. Security analysis included. So I would say this is really nice. The second property is that the plaintext doesn't get longer. The ciphertext is no longer than the plaintext. So in terms of communication overhead, it doesn't cost you anything. So these are the good sides. What are the bad sides? So the first thing is we really need a long, long random number, not just a few hundred bits. If you want to transmit long files, you need a long random number which you have to generate somehow. So if I would talk to you about generating a key of 100 bit and you have no clue how you do it, then I could say, hey, then just toss a coin. If I'm arguing, hey, if you want to transmit a file a few megabytes long, and if you have no clue how to generate the key, then toss a coin often enough, then you would say, hey, now he's fully crazy. He's not only paranoid, he's crazy. Okay, you got the point? Generating a long random number needs, I would argue, hardware. What's the second problem? Let's assume you have generated a long random number. You have to store it. How many times do you have to store it? It depends. Probably first you have to store it somehow here, and after you've distributed the keys, then usually you have to store it at two places. And even more importantly, you have to store it at two secure places. What's the next disadvantage? What's the next problem? At least for one of the two actors, you have to transmit the random number, you have to transmit the key in space in a secure fashion. So in this picture, the key has to make it from here to here, protecting its secrecy. And by the way, of course, its integrity as well, but the secrecy is a point which may be more demanding. What does this mean? We want to protect transmitting something here. And what is the price we have to pay? Protect something of equal length we want to transmit here. So basically this figure tells us, hey, it's more difficult to transmit from in a secure way from left to right than from right to left. This is what the picture is about, if you see very fundamentally. And of course this is ridiculous. So why is it easier to transmit a key of the same length than it is to transmit the plain text? Any argument for that? No idea.
The key is
just pass the mask, then it's easier to.
if he has to be much longer than the first plain text, so that you can communicate for a long time, and you have only to exchange the key once and then communicate maybe for your whole life.
Okay, so you say the first statement of use, I would say it makes it more difficult because you start your argumentation to transmit some plain text of a certain length. I have to exchange a key which is even longer. So this was a negative argument, so it's even more difficult. Usually if you want to have technology, it should get easier. The argument tells me it's more difficult. The second argument, of course, is a good argument. If I succeeded in exchanging a long key, then I can use it. This sounds nice. So how to exchange it in a secure fashion?
Maybe inquire to some kind of special agent who prints you a letter or something like that.
Okay, so you'd say, hey, we need some kind of security service or secure exchange service who takes some keys here and delivers them there. Sounds great, right? So maybe the NSA, the FBI, and the Mossad say, hey, we are the specialists in transporting keys, so we do this service, and maybe we organize it at an international scale. Sounds nice, right? Okay. If you trust these entities, it's fine. Then your problem is solved. If you have slight mistrust against any of them, what do you do now? Probably you have to take it into your own hands. So probably you are traveling from here to there. So now it looks like that the Vernon cipher is a splendid good idea to support airlines, right? If you want to do it at an international scale. Because whenever you want to communicate to someone, first you have to travel, or that person has to travel. Sounds nice. Maybe a good idea to get people into closer relationships, getting international understanding, but maybe the consumption of energy, oil, things like that, maybe tremendous. Any better idea? Okay, now it gets hard, I have to admit it. And now you don't have any general purpose solution. But let's assume you want to exchange a key with your family. When do you do it? When you are together anyhow. So at Christmas, it may be a splendid good opportunity to exchange a key with your parents. No need to travel extra. You are, hopefully, you meet them anyway. And after you explain to them, how the one-hand hat works, it may be a tremendous good idea exchanging a key. By the way, all you need is some kind of random generator to make it really fun. Okay. And how do you exchange keys? Probably you don't write them on paper, right? So you are using a USB stick, a DVD, or whatever. So whenever we have good means of storage, we can use that for key exchange, right? So the same means will enable us to store plain text, enable us, of course, to store keys. And we are together anyway, we can exchange keys. By the way, what I just told you about you and your family is, of course, true whenever some gang, some criminals do it. They can do it as well. And I don't like it, but I'm pretty sure they will do it. Probably their motivation to do it is higher than your motivation and your family. So the downside of this nice system is that whenever you have intelligent criminals, who had ever an opportunity to meet each other, you have no realistic chance to get into their communication content by decryption, because they will exchange keys. So what you can do then is hack any of the domains of trust. But attacking the cryptography directly, if they are using the one-time pattern. And of course, what you also could do, if they are using a bad random number generator, then try to break the random number. Or maybe you should come up with very nice proposals. Whoever is traveling and maybe crossing a border should present all the bits he or she takes with her or him, because this might be a symmetry. So whenever you're crossing the border, please make it clear all your USB keys are read, all the data on the hard drive is copied, just to make sure the government knows all the keys. Sounds like a really workable, nice solution, where surely the criminals on crossing the border will present all the USB keys. So, of course, if I'm a honest person, I will not only hand over to the officer this USB key, but maybe, I think I have a second one. Okay, both keys. So, for instance. And of course, this makes traveling fast, because it's only 8 and 16 gigabytes on each. So it's really fast to copy that and store it. The airlines will not. And so you see, on principle, we could try to do it, but really trying to enforce, you get in all situations all the potential keys, it doesn't work. Therefore, probably it's a reasonable approach, assuming that neither our police nor our secret services can really break the cryptography of those who want really to protect their communication. Okay. So this was the system. And please remember, going back, of course you can break it, but not breaking the cryptography, but the implementation. So this is a really secure system where you can't break the system, but surely you can break the implementation if it's not done in a very secure fashion. Any questions? Do you feel well prepared to have a nice conversation on Christmas with your parents? Try to do it, because I really think you have a good chance of success explaining that system. You get much more complicated system, which are much less suitable for Christmas, but this system is. And by the way, if you succeed explaining that system to your parents, then probably it's easy for you to explain it to me in an oral examination. And of course I want you to explain and to argue why it is secure. Any questions? Okay. Key exchange. I started talking about key exchange in terms of travel. Whenever two entities want to exchange a key, one of the two has to travel. Or I argued about key exchange in terms of, if neither of the two is traveling, then another party is traveling. Of course, if you want to implement systems where a huge number of entities is exchanging with many, many other entities keys, then letting all of them travel doesn't work. It's just too expensive. So, what did we do? We on the idea of one indirection step more. That is, instead of exchanging keys directly between participant A and participant B, we are using one indirection step. For example, we are creating key exchange centers. Here are the big kicks. And then we only have to make sure that participant A and X are exchanging a key. And we have to make sure that participant B and X exchange a key. And then this center can help the two exchange a common key. So, for example, participant A might generate a key K1. This is encrypted with the key exchanged between A and X, called KAX. It's decrypted here, then encrypted by X using the key KBX, the key between X and B, and transmitted to B. And B can once more decrypt it using the key he knows and gets K1. So with this scheme, whenever we make sure that all the participants did exchange a key with X, then the sender X can help all the participants exchange keys with each other. Sounds nice, right? Sounds like a good service. And in particular, it's fast. Even if A and B spontaneously decide we want to communicate, if they manage before that to exchange keys with X, then they can get their key immediately. What's the downside? What's the problem?
They have to trust X.
So both participants have to trust X. What could do X do? What's the problem? In which respect do they have to trust X?
Because X could listen to their communication content.
Okay, that is, X, of course, in this exchange gets to learn the key. And if X ever gets to learn the ciphertext, then of course X can decrypt. So if you want to have an X which is somehow trustworthy, you should make sure that this X never ever is in a position to tap communication. Which of course is an assumption which is hard to fulfill. Historically in the past, just to mention, when this kind of cryptography made it in the mass market, there have been years where the secret services argued, we want to generate the keys, we want to distribute the keys to the whole of society. And at least some parts of society didn't like that because of the arguments suggested. How to improve the system? Think about the main theme of this lecture, security by distributed systems. So what should we distribute? What should we have instead of one entity, several of them? Probably if the key exchange center is a bottleneck, then we might come across the idea, if we have two of them, it might get better. And the answer indeed is, yes, it does get better. Let's assume we have create an additional key exchange center Y, which is managed and operated by a completely different company. Maybe this is X is the Roman Catholic Church, and maybe this is operated by the Party of the Greens. Usually they don't have too much in common, so probably they don't work in a secret fashion together. Or let's assume this is the United States Secret Service. Let's assume this is, what should I argue? Iran Secret Service. Of course, according according to the politics of the day, maybe you have to use different examples each case you are arguing. So maybe what is Iran today is another country tomorrow. Okay, but the idea is clear. With Y, A is exchanging the key K A Y, and with Y, B is exchanging the key B Y. Any of the three is generating a second key K2, which is exchanged, protected by the keys exchanged before that. And then what do we have? A and B now know two keys, key one and key two. Neither of the two exchange key exchange centers knows both keys. And what we now do is A and B add up the two keys bit by bit, mod 2 for example, and come that way across the key K, which they use to encrypt the message. And to tap the content of the communication between A and B, what is needed? You need, of course, the cipher text. Without that, no idea what is communicated. And you need both keys. If you only have one key, it doesn't help you decrypt. So in my example, you would need the cooperation of the US government and Iran. Or maybe you take here North Korea. Okay, North Korea, third actor, sounds great. Okay, let's do it again. So this was US, this is Iran, this is North Korea. Of course now, North Korea, not good. Maybe that Iran and North Korea are somehow working together. Okay, so we have to think about how we get a third party which has no relationship to any of the parties. Okay. Now it gets a topic of political science, of social science, of, okay, surely it gets out of computer science. I'm not the expert in explaining to you which entities are likely to cooperate and which are not likely. But the scheme is simple, and this is, I have to explain. We exchange a key between A and Z, and a key between Z and B. We are using these keys to protect a third key we are generating for transmission of the message K. And of course, A and B now know three keys. So they add them up, all the three of them, mod 2, and encrypting the message with the resulting sum of the keys K. What's your techo model? Someone wanting to get at the content needs the ciphertext and needs all three keys. If he gets only two of them, he doesn't learn anything. Okay, and now I could continue for the rest of the day introducing the fourth, the fifth, etc., etc. How many will we use in practice? Depends, of course. What's the expense? It's pretty clear, the more you are using, the better the confidentiality of the final key, right? But what is the expense? The expense is, of course, exchanging keys with all of them. So if this is US, if this is Iran, if this is North Korea, then joining the system means you are traveling to the US, you are traveling to Iran, you are traveling to North Korea. This is surely nice for sightseeing, but it takes some time and money. And at least some people of you probably wouldn't enjoy traveling to North Korea and Iran. And some would not like to travel to the US. Because if you are traveling to the US, you have to give all your fingerprints to them, and you never know what they really do. I'm not sure whether you have to hand over all your fingerprints if you're traveling to Iran, North Korea. So probably in the US I would feel more comfortable because I know their language. But giving them all my fingerprints is probably not really a good idea. At least from my perspective. Maybe it's a good idea from the US as well. Okay. What else is expensive? It's not really expensive, I would argue, to send, instead of one message, to exchange the key, three messages. This is electronics, it can be just be done in the background of your processes. So what would you do in practice? Probably US, Iran, North Korea is a better idea, right? These three are too far apart. So, Roman Catholic Church of Germany, the Greens of Germany, and maybe the ZAH, the Zentrum für Informationsdienste und Hochleistung, said, hey, this would be a good idea. This is pretty close, and surely they are trustworthy. So let's take that as the third point. Now, it's more manageable. But what do you do now if you want to communicate to someone living in the US? He has to travel now to Dresden to this ZAH. Make contact to the German Greens. Make contact to the German Catholic Church. So you need some kind of hierarchy. So key exchange centers will form some kind of hierarchy and we'll get some exercises. Questions? Can you pass over the mic? So this kind of key exchange usually has to be done physically. And in the easiest way, this means you make a trip to the center as a user. It could be that when you join the network physically, for example, if you get your DSL modem hardware, then in this hardware already you have a key with, for example, your internet service provider. So basically, it needs physical contact. And it's an organizational question which kind of contact you are using, whether you keep key exchange completely separate from all other business relationships, or you integrate key exchange into business transactions which are commonplace. So for example, when you get DSL in Germany, how do you do it? Probably you are going to the local shop of your telco provider, you get your DSL modem there, and this is a situation where you could exchange your key with your ISP. Or maybe on Sunday, you are at an office of the Roman Catholic Church. Usually it's not described as an office, but as a church, and maybe you are exchanging a key there. Maybe on Tuesday evening, you have a meeting with your local branch of the Greens, exchanging. So you're using opportunities.
So if they want to exchange messages with participant B's, you must make sure that B's also have the contact.
Yes, so if you have no better organization, so if everything is done in some kind of anarchic way, then first A and B have to find out what key exchange centers do we have in common. So if A is Roman Catholic, but B is a Protestant, then it's out of that. So maybe Roman Catholic and Protestant Church may have some common key exchange, so forming some kind of hierarchy. But if they haven't, then that A did exchange some key to X and B did exchange some key to another party, this doesn't have the truth. So in some sense, I explain to you the building blocks, but to make it useful, you need some kind of more global arrangement. And this can be, hopefully will be, discussed in the exercises. Further questions?
Why we can't implement all this why we can't implement all these key exchange mechanisms on the part of A and B?
If you haven't any mechanism to bootstrap that in the sense that I said, A and X are exchanging outside of the usual network a key. If you want to do it directly between A and B, you have the problem that you have to send your key through the network. And assuming an attacker who taps the network all the time, this is completely useless. So exchanging the key using the ordinary network only makes sense if you assume that no attacker is tapping the network all the time. So maybe we can arrange that the NSA is sleeping each night 6 hours. Then this would be an opportunity to exchange keys during that time if the NSA is the agency you want to be protected against. But it's ridiculous.
No, and what if we somehow pre-share, first of all, participant A sending his key to the B side, and then B side sending his key to the A side. After that, they're combining somehow this key into the resulting key, and after that, they establish communication.
Coming back, what have I made assumptions? The assumptions was the encryption algorithms are public. So I assume your combination algorithm is public as well. And we assume that here everything is tapped. So, using your example, it means A and B are exchanging messages. Those messages are tapped. And then the content of those messages are somehow combined to arrive at a key with an algorithm which is public. Okay, the attacker can do. So, if I look at it from a fundamental perspective, I would argue it's completely useless. But, of course, if you are discussing between not only black and white, but different tones of gray, of course, if A and B somehow can arrange for an algorithm to combine, they can gain some security. But what is this algorithm to combine? It mainly means somehow they had an opportunity to arrange something in secret before the fact. And if they have a possibility to make some kind of arrangement the attacker doesn't know, then they could exchange a key. And usually, before I would, with all of you, arrange for an algorithm to combine different parts of messages to form a key, I would say, hey, here's my USB stick, please store your name and the key on the stick. Makes life much easier. You see? Okay, further questions? Okay. I should mention that in history, as long as we are talking about one or two or maybe maximum three centers, there have been proposals that national organizations are generating the keys and administrating them, and the buzzwords here have been key escrow and key recovery. So, let's say in the late 80s, the US said, okay, this could be the Department of Commerce, this could be the NSA, and this could be another department within the branch of the US administration, and we are generating the keys. And of course, all those actors have not been considered to be independent enough for the American people to accept that, not to speak about other. So, what did we learn? We learned that for the key generation part, the generation of the random number, and doing the key generation, again we need a domain of trust. And this domain, as I used to talk about, can be at the encryptor side, it can be at the decryptor side, and it can be the key exchange side. It doesn't matter who generates the key, because in the course of exchanging the key, all three get to learn it. So going back, maybe this was a simple thing. It could be that A generates the key, K1. It could be X generates it. It could be B generates it. Because all three will learn K1. So usually, if you're talking about this, who is going to generate it? Probably, often, X, because X will have special hardware to support key generation. And in this situation, it's not a security problem that X is generating the symmetric key, because X is getting to learn it anyhow. Okay. Questions so far concerning symmetric encryption and generation and distribution for symmetric keys. And now I have to talk about a system which, when it was invented, was really a huge surprise. What we had until now, this was done in the military arena, in the diplomatic arena, for many centuries. And people had the feeling, as I explained to you, cryptography is nice, but to get it in place, we have to protect key exchange in the same way as we want to protect the messages. That is, if you want to protect the message content, if you want to have confidentiality, security for the message, we need to exchange keys in a way that the confidentiality of keys is protected. Which mainly means cryptography gives you a choice when you exchange keys, but it doesn't give you a choice about security. You have a choice when you want to provide security or when you have an opportunity to use it, but it's not generated. With asymmetric encryption systems, this is different. The main difference is that key generation now generates not one key, but a pair of keys. One key can be published, we call this the encryption key, and this key may be publicly known. And the other key, called decryption key, this is the key to keep it secret. And then we have an encryption algorithm, which only gets the publicly known encryption key. And this is enough to transform plain text into cipher. And for decryption, the encryption key is not enough. And it must not be enough, because everyone knows it. At least everyone might know it. For decryption, you need the other key of the key. And if you do it, you again get the plain text. First, I would say this is really a nice idea. And of course, the hard question is, do those systems exist? In the sense that we have a generation algorithm to generate key pairs, we have an encryption algorithm to decrypt. And to be frank, I cannot answer the question. Surely there are systems which are used in practice who work exactly like this. But if you're asking me, are there secure systems working like this, the answer is, I don't know. I hope so. Many people hope so. Secret services and banks and others are betting lots of money about that the systems they are using are secure, but there are no proofs. We get a closer look at those aspects soon. So, this is the new idea. Instead of generating single keys, we are generating key pairs. One of the keys of a key pair may be public. It enables encryption. And the other key of a key pair has to stay secret. And only in this part of the key pair enables decryption. With this kind of system, we need a second random number, which has nothing to do with that random number. So here's two independent random numbers, because we have to make the encryption not only dependent on the plain text and on the encryption key. Why this? Probably you should be able to explain it to find out why do we need that big random number.
Because attacker could maybe learn something about the plain text if I reuse the encryption key. And if there are some repeating pattern, maybe the attacker, with the help of statistical models, could learn something about the text.
Let's assume we are only using the public key to encrypt one plain text. Would you need this random number then?
So if the attacker knows this encryption public key and it has this ciphertext, he can read this encrypted text, and this ciphertext is encrypted only with this public key, he can easily decrypt this text with this public key.
Okay, I try to explain it a little bit more in detail. Let's assume an attacker is tapping the ciphertext, right? He knows from which person does this come, and he knows to which person does this go, usually by just inspecting the addresses, right? So in particular, he knows to which person does it go. So he looks up maybe in the public register, what's the public key of that entity, right? So he knows the ciphertext and the public key. Now let's assume that the plain text is either relatively short, maybe just a yes or no, or okay or no, or maybe just darling I love you, which is a message which is relatively easy to guess, and probably it's sent more often than the message darling I hate you, but even this message may be easy to guess. Maybe darling should be replaced by some other words, and that's even more important. So whenever the attacker can guess the plain text, he can check whether his guess was right. And, okay, so you have no need to have success in your first try, you just try to out all probable plain text, encrypt them using the public encryption algorithm and the public key, and compare whether the outcome, whether the result is the ciphertext you just heard on the line. If so, you know certainly that this is the plain text you just used. So in some sense, no decryption is involved whatsoever. And the explanation, I didn't speak about decrypting anything. I just spoke about encrypting things. And of course, remember what you just encrypted. And now, if we add this random number, the attacker would not only have to guess the plain text, but he would have to guess the random number from as well. Why is it more difficult to guess plain text and random number than just guess the plain text? Okay, two arguments. First, because guessing two entities always is more complicated than guessing one entity, okay? But why is it essentially more difficult to guess the plain text and random number than just only the plain text? Okay, ciphertext becomes longer. But why is it so difficult, or so much more difficult, to guess the random number than to guess the plain text?
Because the random number doesn't have any sense, so it's just a number. I want to give you this.
Because we, the cryptographers, we, the implementers of the system, can make sure that there's really a lot of randomness in it, which means that the probability that you can guess it is decreasing very fast with the amount of randomness which is in the number. Whereas we as the cryptographers, we haven't any control about the plain text. Users may decide to send single bit plain text, which of course are very easy to guess what the plain text is. It may just be 0 or 1. So, please keep in your head, when we are using publicly known keys and publicly known algorithms, we need randomness in the encryption process. Otherwise, even very good encryption cannot happen. So what are the domains of trust? First of all, we need here at the encryptor side a domain of trust to store the public key, not to keep it secret, but just to store it. To handle the plain text, of course keep it secret, to generate random numbers, and maybe after you have used them, delete them. And of course, doing the encryption. We need a second domain of trust, which generates random numbers, which does the key generation. And I would argue, which is the same domain of trust as that domain of trust which does the decryption. Why the same domain? Because then the decryption key never has to leave that domain. So you can keep your secret key within the domain all the time. No need to transport secrets through some kind of maybe insecure area. And this is the main advantage of asymmetric encryption system. You keep the secret part of your key pair within your domain of trust. And all you give out to the outside world is the public key, which may by definition be known by everyone. And of course, what I just told you, it was invented by Whitfield Diffie and Martin Hellman. It was a shock, a negative shock to the secret services of the world, because they had no way to get at the key. And of course it was a positive shock to everyone being interested in privacy, or commercial secrets or whatever. I would argue this kind of invention is really a good invention for society, because organized crime will do key exchange even with a symmetric system without any kinds of problems. And here the asymmetric systems will make key exchange for civil society much easier, much more robust. So I would argue this is a good invention, because of course it can be used by the bad guys as it can be used by the good guys. But the increase in power, the increase in possibility is surely at the side of the good guys, not at the side of the bad guys. Assuming they have some distinction between good guys and bad guys, which of course always has to be taken with some grain of salt. So this is, again, no park box, because we are talking about encryption system. I would construct it using a spring lock, so you can close it without having any kind of secret key. You can just lock the box. And then you have one key which corresponds to the secret key to unlock the box. So you can hand over the open box to anyone who should be in a position to send you a secret message. That person can lock the box, and only you have a key to unlock. Again, of course, you need names for the algorithms. So, generation algorithm takes random number Z and outputs a pair of keys. The public key, the random number Z prime, is taken by the encryption algorithm together with the plain text, and then the ciphertext, the Schlüssel text, is generated. And here, the decryption algorithm takes the Schlüssel text, ciphertext, and the decryption key. You can expand that and generates finally the plain text X again. Usually, those asymmetric decryption systems are needing much more computation. They are computationally much more expensive than symmetric systems. This is pretty clear if you compare it to the one-time pad. Their encryption-decryption was really, really cheap. It was just doing some operation in some room. Very simple to put a key, was two. And here, with asymmetric encryption system, usually doing their own phonetics takes some effort. So symmetrical cryptography, the one who had, you can do it in your head, but doing asymmetric encryption within your head would need a tremendous amount of escorting and would not be valuable for your mental health. If you do it really, of course, small example, we do the exercises, and I hope you can do it without escorting. Any questions? Then key distribution. Here, key distribution is much simpler. Basically, we only need one public key register, R. And the procedure is that A is generating a key pair and is taking his public key to the center and registers his public key there. This may be doing some kind of contract in writing, hey, this is my public key, here's my passport, please sign. And then you have a contract, both parties signing it. Or it could be that even you register your public key anonymously for some source. If B wants to communicate to A, B sends a message to R, and then by R gets the public key of A. And what we will see that R is signing, is authenticating the key it sends. And this signing, this asymmetric authentication, we'll come to that in after the break in a few minutes, gives proof that if R is misbehaving, R can only misbehave in telling B the wrong public key. For example, a public key which R generated itself. So by authenticating this third message, requiring that R does it, B would get proof if R ever cheated. And B could prove that to everyone on Earth. And then, of course, nobody would use the services of the public key register R any further. So R would go out of business immediately. Finally, B can use the public key CA of A to encrypt the message. That's it. Of course, this procedure is very simple. This message here can be public. You could put that on a postcard if you like, your public key, a photocopy of your passport, and you send it there. No secrecy. If R is going to cheat, B gets proof of that. And B could send this third message to A. So even better, A would get proof about that R is cheating with respect to his public key. And A has a written contract with R, what R shall be doing, what R shall not. So A could bring the register R to court. Nice. And of course, if A and B don't use the same register, again you need some kind of hierarchy of registers. But here, again it's much simpler because the register doesn't get any secret information. It only gets public information. Therefore, needing a chain of register, a hierarchy of register, is much more reasonable than having a hierarchy of entities who have to keep secrets. Here, the register only has to keep the integrity? Not secret. The
first question was,
hey, if you are talking about a domain of trust, what do you mean? Okay. The starting point is, if I'm talking about this domain of trust, I would argue this is a domain where the party at the left-hand side has to trust into integrity, availability, and confidentiality of this computer here. And basically, at the right-hand side, same argument. It's another party, it's another equipment usually, and again that party has to trust in integrity and availability as well as confidentiality there. So the starting point is each party, each single party needs its trusted domain. So far everything seems to be simple. Now if we look at the plaintext, which we want to keep secret. We have the plaintext here, and we have the plaintext there. So, for this party to be sure that the plaintext is kept secret, what do we need? Of course, this party needs its domain of trust, first. And secondly, this part also needs that the communication partner, first, wants to keep the message secret as well. This is an assumption about the communication partner, maybe as a person or an organization. And secondly, that this communication partner has, of course, a domain of trust of its own, of his or her own. So basically, to trust in the secrecy, the confidentiality of this plaintext, you have three assumptions. My computer is secure, my communication partner wants to keep the message secure, and his or her computer is secure. And this, of course, for that kind of protection, or keeping that plaintext confidential, the domain of trust you need is much larger than your domain of trust. It comprises your communication partner's domain of trust as well as that person. So, what I didn't spell out, neither on the slides nor in the scriptum, how these domains of trust are related. So what the remark I make, of course, is when we start with each party, each entity needs its own domain of trust. This is a starting point. And of course, with respect to particular data, particular protection goals, usually or quite often, you have to have stronger assumptions than just that your domain of trust is secure, is trusted. So this was the first thing. Please remind me when we go through the slides in the authentication arena, where it's sometimes slightly different than as in the secrecy arena, that I discuss this as well. If I don't do it from my point of view, please ask, because this is important. Second question I got was, hey, if you look at this slide, what do we really win by introducing this key exchange set? What's the real gain? I hope I did explain it before that, but in case I didn't, I just try to repeat as clearly as possible. First, if A, in the beginning, already knows that it wants to communicate to B, and this is the only secure communication A ever wants to add, then surely it doesn't make sense for A to exchange a key with X, and later on, hoping, or even before that, hoping that X and B somehow exchange a key. If the only communication A wants to secure is communication between A and B, A would exchange a key with B, period. So the indirection step towards X only makes sense if, while doing this key exchange, this exchange of the key KAX, A does not already know that it's communicating later on to B, or if he has the feeling, and we not only communicate to B, but many other entities. And in this situation, it makes sense to do the indirection step, to exchange a key between A and X. And this really gets rewarding, this really pays off if many other parties exchange keys with X as well. And then you gain flexibility later on, that you can decide spontaneously to whom you want to communicate to in a secure fashion. Okay? Next question I got, it's less fundamental, but I should mention it nevertheless, was, hey, how about traveling and how about sending something by mail? Is it really necessary to travel from here to there, or if you want to exchange keys directly, to travel there? The answer is no. If you have the feeling that physical mail or courier is working fine and keeping the confidentiality, then of course you can send this by physical mail. Or you could even exchange the key between A and B by physical mail. Of course, I could argue then you could send your plaintext message by physical mail as well. But again, of course, sending it digitally by electronic means is much faster. So usually doing some key exchange, even if you do it by physical mail, directly between A and B, has the advantage that after you succeeded exchanging the key, then communication is possible. Okay, so this was next question. Then I got a question, yes, here. How does the recipient strip off the random number? How can he keep separate plain text and random number from? And the answer is, because we are agreeing on some kind of message format. That is, I stressed when I gave you an introduction into cryptography, the algorithms are public, right? Because otherwise you can't implement an open system. And of course, the message formats are public as well. So, in the simplest case, we could say, hey, this random number, this pink random number, gets part of the plaintext. We take part of the space for the plaintext for the random number. Let's say the first 100 bits. And then the recipient knows the first 100 bits of each message I get is random numbers. So I don't start as a human being reading the first 100 bits, which usually wouldn't be much fun. It's just be garbage. Even Kiswahili would make much sense to us reading it compared to reading a random number. Kiswahili is some kind of African dialect I'm not able to talk. So we skip the first 100 bits and then we go. Okay, these have been the questions versus back to content. Any more questions? Are the explanations clear? Then I've got another question which gets more personal, or let's say at another level. Hey, why are you using so simple patterns in your examples? So usually the US Secret Services are mainly portrayed as bad or threatening. You are mentioning countries like North Korea or Iran, but never ever you mention the Netherlands or Luxembourg, things like that. Why are you using so simple patterns? Do you really feel that this is appropriate? Or shouldn't students from North Korea and Iran stand up, leave the room and say, you're crazy? So, first statement, I'm using these patterns, these simple patterns, because I want to denote or to explain some structures. I'm not addressing that the US is more bad than China or vice versa. Both are larger countries. I'm only addressing that usually North Korea and the US probably won't collaborate. So I'm using very simple examples because hopefully that makes the structure of my argument, and I'm aiming at the structure, easier to understand. I don't want to say anything in particular about US and US services, nor Iran and Iran secret services, nor North Korea and North Korean secret services. Okay? So apologize. Apologies for everyone whose country I take as an example to tell a story where he has a feeling, hey, in substance that's nonsense. But usually I'm telling the story because I want to talk about structures. Forgive me that I take a few minutes just to talk about that, but because I started, hey, there's nothing like the good guys and the bad guys in the beginning when I explained multilateral security. Then someone came to me and said, hey, how can you use so simplistic examples? You started telling us there are no good guys and no bad guys, and now you are using these and those countries. Like that. Okay. Hopefully you got my point. And it could be interesting to meet in other forums and discuss about politics. And then, of course, I would be much more careful if you state something about the country. Okay. So, encryption now is behind us. And just to repeat, encryption is the use of cryptography to keep message content secret. This is probably what you have read in the books you did read as a child about encryption, about cryptographic systems. But cryptography can not only be used for confidentiality, it can be used for integrity. And as I mentioned, for each secure system, we have both protection goals requiring confidentiality, and we need integrity as well. And therefore, it's fundamental, it's very important that we have with cryptography, a tool which can be used for integrity as well. This application of cryptographic systems I will call an authentication system. That is an authentication system, and the following is a cryptographic system used for integrity. And as with encryption, authentication can be done in a symmetric fashion and in an asymmetric fashion. And again, I start with the symmetric fashion. We will have an algorithm in public algorithm which takes plain text and a key, outputs the plain text, so the plain text stays there in plain text. This is not a confidentiality system. And added to the plain text will have something which I call a message authentication code, MAC, which is a kind of authenticator for the plain text. And this authenticator is calculated using plain text and key by the algorithm encoder. At the recipient side, we have an algorithm test which takes the MAC and the plain text, and of course the key, which is in the symmetric system the same key, and checks whether plain text and MAC fit together, assuming the key is chosen to be the right key. If so, the output is a plain text plus it did work out or it didn't work out. It didn't work out, I call that pass, means the plain text has been sent exactly as it arrived with very high probability. You can't achieve that, I could now argue, has been sent as it arrived with certainty. This we cannot achieve because there's always at least a small possibility that an attacker changing plain text and MAC by chance at least succeeds. Therefore, all we can achieve is that if we get here a pass, that the recipient knows the plain text is authentic with very high probability. Because we are talking about a symmetric system, key generation, which as usual takes a random number, generates single keys which are used in the encoding process, the same key as in the decoding, the testing process. And only then, and if the plain text and authenticator match, the result should be passed. If you should take, or if you take different keys here and there, then the outcome should be fail. So, if you get a fail, there may be many, many possibilities why you get a fail. It can be the plain text has been changed. It can be the authenticator has changed. It can be both has been changed. Or it can be that the authenticator and the plain text are completely okay. But key management did some failure and two different keys have been used. Okay. As usual, we need domains of trust. As with symmetric encryption, if my aim is, as a sender, that my plain text gets there and the other is able to check and to rely on what I send, of course, in some sense, I make an assumption on my domain of trust and an implicit assumption about the domain of trust of my communication partner. Of course, if this machinery is not working well, then probably we will never ever take my message as authentic. To arrive at a physical analogon, I take the metaphor of a shout case. In German, you would say Glaskasten, Aushangkasten. And I assume that a showcase has a lock. So whatever is put into the showcase, if the integrity of the glass and the lock is given, shall be seen as other. So, in a symmetric system, you would have two locks. One lock is used to put it into the showcase, and the other key is used to test whether this is the right lock, because we don't have a seal at the showcase. It's just about keys checking whether this is the right showcase. If you want to put that into software, then again, surprise, surprise, you need names for the algorithms. So generation exactly the same as generation for symmetric encryption systems. Code takes as parameters the key and the plaintext X and generates the MAC. Test can be implemented very simple. You just take code. So you take just here as an implementation what you have done already there. This is reusing of code done in a good way. And as parameters, code takes the key from here and the plain text from there, and you regenerate here what has been generated hopefully there, and you compare the outcome of what you generate locally with what you get. And if this matches, because it's the same key K, it's the same plain text S. And code, of course, is a deterministic algorithm, so it should start with the same set of parameters, generate the same outcome. So if the same MAC is generated, then the message is taken to be authentic, and the plain text is taken to be authentic. If you look at this scheme, it's pretty clear that what you transfer through the area of attack is longer than the plaintext, because it's the plaintext plus MAC. And the message authentication code usually is 30, 50, 100, 200 bits. Any questions? We'll see examples for authentication codes later. Okay. How about key exchange? Do I have to tell you anything new? No. Key exchange problem is exactly the same as we had it for symmetric encryption. Exactly the same. Therefore, no slide about it. Now I come to another kind of system, if you take it systematically, the asymmetric authentication system. But nobody calls it asymmetric authentication system, because it's so important that it got a unique name. It's called digital signature system. You know what a signature is? You know at least what a handwritten signature is? You learned that at school. And if you think about its purpose in a business scenario, then a handwritten signature should have the property that you put it under a document. Hopefully the document format is such that if you put it under it, later on the document cannot be changed anymore. Which, if you just write on plain paper, may be a daring assumption. But let's assume you are writing on paper where the number of characters is given by the paper structure. So if you take paper we used at school for calculation, for mathematics, with all these kinds of coordinates. And you say within each field one character, and then you sign in the next field, using the next fields which haven't been used by your message. So, okay, if you do it carefully, you can get a situation where a handwritten signature is really using the proper format of your messaging paper authenticates that particular message. And the property, of course, we assume is that it's only you being able to deliver your signature. But we assume usually that everybody is able to check it. Often checking means you need some kind of reference, you need another signature which is considered to be genuine, for example on your passport. And then you compare it and say, okay, this is a signature. So asymmetry then means you are able to sign with your signature. Everyone else, of course, is not able to sign with your signature. This is an asymmetry. But to make your signature still useful, everybody else is still able to test, to authenticate your signature. So here, going one step back, I mentioned I can, in a symmetric fashion, implement the test algorithm by just reusing the algorithm I had at the left-hand side. I can just reuse code. Here, no way to do it. Because if I would enable someone who is assumed to test signatures to regenerate the signature, to sign, then no asymmetry anymore. Then even the guy at the left-hand side could sign, which is not the purpose of asymmetric authentication, which is not what we assume if we are talking about a digital signature. So what happens? We are doing key generation. The outcome is a pair of keys. Key S we are using for signing, and we keep it, hopefully, secret. A key T, this is the isopropyl of the key pair, for testing signatures, and this key shall be publicly given. So we take as assignment the plaintext and the signing key, employ the algorithm to sign it, and the output is the plaintext and the signature. Sometimes I call it and the digital signature. The test key takes plaintext and signature, and the test key, and the output is plaintext, signature, and the attribute pass or fail, that is, the signature authenticates the plaintext with respect to that public key, yes or no. For reasons I cannot explain at the moment, but I already want to mention it, in some situations it may be worthwhile to randomize the signing process. The reason for that I can only explain to you, let's say, in a few months. But just take note, as we had it, asymmetric encryption, some randomization at the encrypt part. Here we might have some randomization at the signing part. Domains of trust. The starting domain of trust is at the right-hand side. We need a domain of trust to generate random numbers, to do the key generation, to store the secret key for signing, and of course to listen. And if you need some additional random numbers, then generate them and use them. And then, of course, the recipient needs a domain of trust. And here it's specific that here we have no need for any kind of confidentiality. We only need here integrity. Because the test algorithm is public, everybody may know. The test key is public, everybody may know. The plaintext is public, everybody may know it because we transmit it through the area of attack. The signature is public, everybody may know, right? So in principle, everybody may do the test. So the test result may be public, everybody may know. Now I started, after the break, with the explanation how do domains of trust relate. And here, probably, within all the four systems, it's the situation where the two domains of trust are decoupled, are unrelated in the strongest sense. Because someone doing signatures has the interest that nobody else shall be able to do signatures which are attributed to that person. So this person wants to keep the secret signing key under his or her exclusive control. So he or she is able to sign. And to provide for this, it's completely okay if you have this single domain of trust. Because none of your secrets ever leaves that domain. Here, a person wants to check whether a signature is genuine, whether it's valid. Because maybe this plaintext and that signature together will be needed if you ever have a problem and want to go to court. So you have proof that someone did send something. So here surely you have some kind of integrity demand. You want to be sure that if you tested the signature, everybody else using the right test algorithm, the right test key, and the plaintext and the signature will get the same result. But here with digital signatures, the interests of the two parties are really different, which gives us a possibility to make a good separation between the domains of trust. At the right-hand side, the interest is, hey, I want to be sure that no false signatures are attributed to me. And this is something the domain of trust can, in some sense, guarantee on the assumption that the key distribution has been done. Of course, if an attacker manages to cause that you are responsible for a test key which is not your test key, then of course you get into problems. But assuming key generation went well, then this domain of trust is able to guarantee your security interests. Completely. Here, in some sense, the same. Someone getting a signature and testing it. What does he want to have in the long run? He wants to have something which is considered a proof before God. And the rules are set out. The test procedure, a key, and then the outcome. So if I'm only interested in having a proof before a court, I'm only interested in the left-hand side, whether my partner's domain of trust is working fine. It's not my problem. If here I get a message, I transmit $100,000 to you, I don't care about the security of the person. It's nice to get proof having $100,000. That's nice. You see? Okay, in the long run, of course, now we have to discuss how does the legal system cope with the situation that someone's domain of trust may be broken into. Does this invalidate signatures? How to handle that? But these are mainly now secondary effects. We come to that in the exercises and in discussing particular systems. But as a starting point, these two domains of trust serve quite separate interests. Okay? The physical analogon, again, showcased with Locke, and this time only we have one key. So the key now is the secret sign key, so to put some message into the showcase, and the asymmetry then is provided for that everybody knows whom the showcase who owns the showcase, I should say this. Again, we need names for algorithms. So key generation applied to the random number Z gives us pairs of keys for testing for signatures. The signing algorithm taking the signing key, the plain text, and maybe the random number Z prime generates a signature. We transfer plain text and signature. The test key taking the public key for testing, the plain text, and the signature gives us as a result passing fail. And all this, the plain text, the signature, and the test result, we pass over to the outside world. Just to give you a subtle remark, here we pass to the outside world the authenticator, the digital signature. If I go back, here we did pass to the outside world only the plain text, and whether it's okay or not, we didn't pass the message authentication code. Why didn't we pass the message authentication code to the outside world? Because the outside world cannot use it in any way. The outside world has not the key. The key is assumed to be only here and there, and therefore it doesn't make sense to pass the neck to the outside world. No way to do any useful stuff with it. With the digital signature, this is dramatically different. Everybody who has the test algorithm and the test key can retest the signature. And therefore, it makes sense to give plain text and signature together to the outside world, because then everyone can revalidate whether this passing failure is calculated in the right way or in the wrong way, whether it's valid or not. So please, as one homework, start with 4 blank pieces of paper and write down all the 4 systems and think about which symbols you write where. What stays within which area? What is given outside? Why is it given outside? Etc. 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 Please take some time. It sounds so easy if I explain it to you. But usually there are some arguments behind whether something is there or not. Please discover these arguments. And only if you have discovered them, you may feel confident that you will demonstrate it and can answer. Okay. So digital signatures, many books would now stop here and say, okay, I've told you everything you should know about digital signatures. But I want to add some kind of warning, because digital signatures remain. The anthropomorphic argument gives you the feeling, hey, we are signing messages with digital signatures. And in some sense this is true, and in another sense this isn't true. What you sign with a digital signature is bit strings. What is the meaning of the message? What is the meaning of the bit string when interpreted as a message is a completely different story. Maybe you need an example. When the first codes, character codes, were made, bits were really expensive. So they tried to work with a 6-bit code. So 6-bit code means 2 to the power of 6 possibilities. So you have the lowercase characters, the uppercase characters, you have some numbers, and 10 numbers and some particular characters. And then all the 64 possibilities are filled, right? So the first nation, to the best of my knowledge, having some standardization of such a code have been the US. And after a while, in Great Britain, the English people, at least the English computer scientists, had the feeling that we want to have some kind of standard code for Great Britain as well. And of course we want to be competitive with the Americans. But they haven't a symbol you really need. They haven't a symbol for pound sterling. So we should add it. But adding it would mean all the 64 possibilities are already filled. So adding a 65th character would need a 7th bit. Too expensive. Don't do it at that time. So in Great Britain they thought, is there any US symbol we don't need? And after some while of thinking, they said, yes, we don't need the dollar sign. So they had this splendid good idea, let's reuse the bit pattern of the dollar sign for Great Britain, meaning pound sterling. Great idea, saved lots of bits, kept the whole e-commerce business much cheaper, right? What is the problem now? If you are signing a contract in the US digitally and you read it and you come across this pattern, meaning US dollar, pound sterling, probably you will have the feeling it quite probably means US dollars. And if you are signing the contract in this strange island who feels at the same way they are part of Europe and they aren't, so they got their mind really scared. So if you sign the contract on that island, probably it means pound sterling. So at the very least, you need not only the plain text and the digital signature, you need the location where you signed it. And even better, it would be, of course, that you would say, hey, we stick to the US alphabet or we stick to the English alphabet. Because what would it mean if you sign such a contract in German? Would it be US dollar? So please keep in mind that digital signature systems only sign bits. And this is what I wanted to denote by, hey, this is only a sequence of bits. We are signing only sequences of bits. And this is not only a funny story. Of course, the story with the US dollar and the pound sterling is really a nice story. I love it. Therefore, I tell it each week. Maybe I even tell it twice. But if you think about message formats today, the same sequence of bits can mean so many different things. And for example, it would be splendid good if you could say, hey, someone comes up with the signature of yours. Maybe the signature means, hey, I owe you $1,000, comes up with the signature and says, hey, I want the $1,000. And then you could argue, hey, this is just modern music of Stockhausen, played in your MP3 player, and you will appreciate. Sounds for some years somewhat strange, because not everyone likes Stockhausen, but I do. And therefore, because this is my favorite song, I signed it to keep it authentic. $1,000 for you? No, we bear. You get the point? So it's really important that if you sign something, the meaning of the bits is part of the document, is defined in some standard way in the document you sign it. And if you talk about computer architecture and security in general, I even would argue, in practice, we need much more. Let's assume you're signing a document. Let's assume a Word document. I never would encourage to do so, because what a Word document is very ill-defined. But let's assume you're daring to sign a Word document. And later on, let's assume you have a contract. The major part of your contract is in black. And the fine print is in blue. Let's assume. You sign. Your partner has a copy. And then, in a conflict, later on, your partner insists, hey, and in the fine print you can read that you are obliged to do this and that. And then you argue, oh, fine print, never came across that. I have blue as a background color on my screen, exactly matching the fine print. I never noticed that there was any fine print. So my signature doesn't relate to the fine print. I just designed, just signed the red part of our contract, the blue part. Blue is the background color of my screen. Bad luck. At least bad luck for one of the two. At least a surprise for one of the two. So in some sense, to check what the signature really should mean, you should be able to reconstruct the full setting of the system the signature has been done. Was blue really the background color or not? And depending on that, the answer to that question, it can shift quite some money from here to there. So in some sense, it's not only necessary that you encode the message into the message format, let's say the standard semantics of your message. In some sense, it is even necessary to encode the whole of your system state, at least all parts of your system state which might have an influence on what a person sees into a signature, which of course is quite clumsy. So, you see, if you want to use digital signatures really as a replacement for handwritten signatures, it's not as easy as it sounds. And some people trying to do implementations of that really got some surprises. Okay. Key distribution. Key distribution is pretty close to what you learned about asymmetric encryption. And again, in step one, participant A, let's generate his key and let's register his public test key with the public key register R. Register his public test key TA with the public key register. If participant B receives a message from A signed with a signature from A, in step two, B requests the key for testing the signature file from the key register. And in step three, he receives the key tier A for testing the signature of A from the register R, certified by the signature of R. That is, R, again, uses digital signatures. B knows the public key of the register R, and so the signature system is used to authenticate the keys distributed by the public key register. And this is the mechanism I already mentioned to make sure that if the register R delivers a wrong key, it can be held liable for doing this mistake. So participant B and A, by this signature here, get proof what and how the register R answered that query asked in message 2. And then after participant B got the test key of A, he just tests the digital signature. And if the outcome is everything is okay, everything is fine, then he takes the message from A as general.
I have a question regarding the key distribution for the asymmetric encryption. You see it in this case you can, as you said, actually see if it's the right, if R delivered the right test key. But if you look at the asymmetric encryption, if you assume an attacker um, doesn't check the signature of R, then you can,
Okay, just explaining this protocol a little bit. I assume that if B wants to send a message to A, in some sense B knows at least a little bit about A. If you want to send a message in a confidential way to just anybody, okay, confidentiality is meaningless. So, starting point is, participant B knows at least some name of A. To make sure that the register can do any useful service, this name B knows about A has to be a match to the identity A gives when registering his public key. So in this example, it would just be A. But we could take different names there. So assume that the question asked in step two is matching what has been done in step one. That is, this A is matching that A. And then we assume that in step three, R is signing that A, this again is the A, has the public key CA. And then B will check for the following. He will check that what comes back, this A, is what he asked for. And he will check whether the signature matches the database, which is the relationship between A and CA, relative to the public key of the register. If so, B knows that now he has proof that register R certified the relationship between A and CA. And usually signatures also have a date and a time. So the more precise statement is, at this moment in time, CA is the key attached to the name A. If this is wrong, participant B has a proof that the register R did cheat. Usually this will not very much upset B, because the cheating of the register R mainly is about A. But maybe it upsets B as well, I don't know. And in any case, we should construct the protocol such that B somehow communicates to A, telling A, hey, this is the answer I got from R. And now if this answer is wrong, then A has any reason to be upset, because he has some contract with R, and A should bring R before court, and of course publish the story. Usually on the internet, you don't go to court, you're just publishing information and getting some not so well behaving entities out of business. So this is in more smaller steps, in more concrete terms. Let's go with that. Is this answering your question, or is still something remaining?
Would you need another entity to check whether the R signature is right?
I assume that participant B as A know the public key of the register R. So I assume that when A and B first register with the register R, in this process they get the public key of R. So if I go even further back, here we had the situation that in the beginning they exchange symmetric keys, right? And with the public key register, what is exchanged is that participants get to learn the public key of the register, just to later on be in position to test signatures of the register. And secondly, that if they want to register a public key of their own, they of course give it to the register and set up maybe some contract or the policy, what to do with the key, how to revoke it, etc. Okay. Further questions? So probably, if you now start about what is the most fundamental kind of system we are talking about, how would you start? I would start with the digital signature system. I would say the system I would bring into place first would be a system to digitally sign stuff. Why that? Because it's they're relatively easy to do updates of your keys, to revoke keys, to do key management. And you need the digital signature system to manage your asymmetric encryption keys. So if you start with the digital signature system, you can use it to authenticate public keys for encryption. So I give you an explanation that I started with the symmetric systems and I started with the encryption systems because this is the kind of system probably you did read about in the books you did read as a teenager. If I would start from a systems architecture point of view, I would have to start with the digital signature system, because this is usually the basis we are building upon. Next, I would introduce the asymmetric encryption system, because this is usually the second step. This is usually how we manage keys today. And then I would say, hey, and for efficiency reasons, computational efficiency, we, in some situations, are using symmetric systems as well. So I mainly would introduce symmetric systems as an efficiency improvement. Okay, but I did it in the other way because probably it's easier to find. But from systems perspective, it's the other way around. And last remark, this was again one of the very good questions over the break. Do you know already some of these systems? And the answer is yes and no. If you are using PGP, usually you have a public key which can be used both for testing signatures and for doing encryption. And mainly the asymmetric cryptography in PGP is used for distributing symmetric keys for efficiency. And this kind of systems I would call a hybrid encryption system, will come to that later. Some slides to follow about this in a few minutes. So what I talked about here mainly is a background how to construct, how to use at an architecture point of view or from an architecture point of view systems like PGP. Okay. Any questions? Okay, then we proceed. Some remarks about key generation. You remember my jokes when I told you that the Secret Services proposed to generate cryptographic keys for society. This was a good joke, and in some sense it's a good joke because it really is true, they proposed that. why did they propose that?
Okay.
There are obvious reasons, because it's a game about power. But secondly, there's some engineering aspect. To generate keys, we need randomness. And randomness needs either special equipment or patience. If you are tossing coins, how many bits per second randomness do you generate? I would assume 1 bit randomness each 3 or 4 seconds. So now can you calculate how expensive randomness is? As an engineer, you are paid, let's say, 30 euros per hour, so you can calculate how many cents a bit of randomness costs. Randomness isn't cheap if you are not using special equipment. And at the time the discussion took place, mainly it was the secret services who had special equipment for generating randomness. So in some sense, their proposal, hey, we are going to generate the keys for you, was not only complete nonsense. It had some part of substance in it. And of course, again today, and this is a discussion you will hear if you get into the business, if you get part of the discussions. Even today, some people will argue to generate good randomness really is an art, not only a science, it's an art. And you should do, or you should let it do, let it be done by the specialists. And then after some arguments, you are at the point that those guys will argue, you are better off if a special unit generates the keys. Maybe a special unit generates the keys for the government. Maybe your bank is generating the key for its customers, etc. So you end up with that chain of argument in a situation where someone tries to convince you that your security is increased if someone else is going to generate your key. And the question, of course, is, if you now think very seriously about it, is this a true argument? And for that, I would draw a small graph. What's the argument? The argument is, okay, for starting the process of generating keys, we surely need randomness. I could go back. Here we need randomness. We can go to the symmetric system. Here we need randomness, etc. So the very basis for all the systems is we need randomness in the beginning for the key generation. If you have good randomness, fine. So the argument I buy from the Secret Service is good randomness is needed for key generation. Yes. And now, if the BND, Bundesnachrichtendienst in Germany, here can use an example of my home country, comes up and says, hey, we should help the German population generating better keys, having better randomness, then my argument would be, okay, if you are really bothering about my security and you have the feeling I haven't good enough randomness, then please give me some randomness. Maybe you deliver it on a USB stick or on a DVD or whatever. Give me randomness. And if someone else bothers, maybe you are quite active, you maybe enjoy the lecture, you have the feeling, it's a nice guy, I should help you generate good randomness. Then maybe give me a piece of randomness as well. And everybody else who wants to give me randomness, nice. you may generate it by quite different means. You can toss a coin. You can hire some monkeys typing on the keyboard. You can measure the time difference between the keystrokes, and if you take only the least significant bits of that, then probably monkeys type as good as you type. And it doesn't matter whether you type 10 fingers or 2 or 1 or whatever. Even if you would type with your nose on the keyboard, if you only take the least significant bits as a random message, it would work out. So many, many ways you could get, produce randomness, and so I get a lot of randomness, either by you or by different approaches. Of course, I can, as a person, toss a coin, type like a monkey, and whatever. So I have randomness. Of course, it's hard to know what randomness is best. Is it better to toss a coin? Is it better to type like a monkey? What is the best approach to be as random as possible? Hard question. So what you would like to have is a procedure to say the procedure combines different kinds of randomness, and the outcome of the procedure is at least as random as the most random part combined. Then the difficult decision what to take is easy. I take all. And at the very least, the result is as random as the most random part. And maybe in practice it may even be more random. Assuming that the most random part is not perfectly random, then it could even be better than the most random part. And the procedure how to do it is a procedure we already had. What did we have? Oh, let's go back. Here, our procedure. We just added keys bit by bit. And you could only calculate the sum if you had all the keys. Or, in other words, the randomness of the sum is at least as random as the most random key. Okay. And this I did put into a picture, being hopefully a good picture to explain it to politicians. And in some sense, it was a success. So maybe you get some randomness by the production plant of your integrated circuit. Maybe they insert a noisy diode or whatever. Maybe some key added here. Maybe some person is typing like a monkey. Maybe at another situation it's a time. And all of these randomnesses are added up bit by bit, resulting in a random bit stream. And this is the starting point for the key generation. That is, the argument of the Secret Service, we know better than you do how to generate randomness, may be true. I don't know. I have the feeling that typing like a monkey is roughly okay, tossing coins is even better, and the time intervals are pretty good. But even if all this is wrong, I shouldn't take a key generated by the Secret Service, but I should say then, hey, if you are in a better situation to generate randomness than I am, please give me some randomness. And I will introduce it in my key generation process. Just as explained. And now it gets interesting, and never ever did any Secret Service show up with me and say, and here's your randomness. We care about your security, please, citizen. Here you have the randomness. All I got, I as offer is, we are going to generate your keys. And this I say, thank you. If you want to help me, we have a random stone, not keys. And therefore, after being through that discussion, full circle, I would argue, hey, they don't care about my security. They care about understanding. Otherwise, they would show up with each of you and me and give us some randoms. So it took me quite some time trying to convince different holders or different providers of infrastructure of this company. For example, the banks. And the first version of home banking software had the feeling keys are generated by the bank and given to the customer. And it's only with that kind of picture that you can convince bank managers that maybe they give to each customer a random string, and maybe this random string is integrated into key generation as described, but the bank shouldn't generate the keys for the customer. It should be a broker doing. It's not that I'm requiring bank customer to toss a coin 200 times. In the meantime, many banks enable that, at least if you're using the home banking computer interface and things like that, that bank users generate their key. Many smart card companies in the meantime have been convinced that key pairs are generated on the smart card. 10 years ago, they did generate it on external equipment and then loaded the key pair into the smart card. And it has been pictures and arguments like this. At the right hand side, you have this domain of trust where you are bundling key generation and signing in one device, and if this picture is say how you combine randoms in your property. So in the meantime, I'm slightly optimistic, but it was hard work. In Germany, let's see what's going to happen. The next generation of our personalausweis, there will be some cryptography in it, some possibilities to sign, and whenever it gets on the market, have a closer look how keys are generated. And if it's done in the wrong way, then give them a smile or don't use it. Further comments on the key exchange. Whom are keys assigned to? In asymmetric systems, we are assigning keys to individual participants. If you are talking about symmetric systems, we are assigning keys to pair relations. That is, two participants, A and B, Alice and Bob, get a common symmetric key. I will in this lecture not talk about assigning keys to groups, nor will I assign asymmetric key pairs to pair relations. I will do the key management to as small groups as possible, because usually it's much better for security. Because if you are assigning symmetric keys not just to two people, but many more people, then the security, of course, decreases, because the more computers the secret is stored on, the easier it is to get at the secret. How many keys have to be exchanged if we have n participants? The answer is, if in asymmetric systems, we have to exchange n keys per system. So if you have one system like in PGP, then it's one key per participant. If we would have a completely different system for digital signatures and encryption, it would be two per participant. And if you want to have some backup systems, it could even be more. With symmetric systems, how many keys are we going to exchange? Each of the end participants is going to exchange a key with all but one of the participants, with all other participants. By intention, I'm not dividing by two. If you're just looking how many pairs there are, and you take unordered pairs, I would have to divide by two. But there are very good reasons to use different keys in each direction. For example, with the one-time pad, it is pretty clear. If you're using the same one-time pad for both directions, okay, you can imagine what happens if two people send a message at the same time. You're just going to add up the two messages, the keys will cancel, and what you have is the sum of two plain text messages, which, given enough redundancy in natural language, you can understand both messages. So having a different key for each direction in the system is a splendid good idea. And now, another thing is n times n minus 1, of course, is much larger than this n. So if you look at it in a naive way, you would say key management is much more expensive for the symmetric systems because there are so many more keys, right? Okay, true. But if you look how many keys each station, each computer has to store, then the difference is not really there. How many keys do you have to store? It's the same number in both systems. It's roughly n. When a key is generated and exchanged, in asymmetric systems, usually you are exchanging keys in the very beginning. At least you are generating them in the very beginning. In larger systems, let's assume n is in the order of the number of humans living on Earth, maybe in two decades, maybe even much larger, because each device has a key, and then at that time probably each human being has a few tenths of devices, then n times n minus 1 is really a large number. And probably you won't generate all the keys in the very beginning. Why not? Because most of the keys we never will need. And therefore, it's silly to generate them in the very beginning. So you see that generating and distributing asymmetric and symmetric keys quite different. Last remark, and this is the closing remark today, the security of the key exchange limits the security available by the cryptographer. That is, the security services implemented by cryptography get never ever more secure than the security of the key exchange. Because if someone is able to intervene there, no security gets there. And therefore, it may be a tremendous good idea to do your initial key exchange several times using different crypto systems, using different organizational settings, and so on and so forth. So please, keep in mind, your security will never be better than your key exchange. So, if you want to rely on services, make sure that your initial key exchange works.